I got good at faking it, but it never felt good. The phrase that often comes with it is, there is no daylight between the U.S. and the U.K. as it relates to, and then fill in whatever foreign policy topic is in the headlines that day. I must have said it 1,000 times.
Hello there, I'm Rich Kilgariff. You're listening to the Bocomi Cast. This week, as the G7 summit leaders left the beaches of Cornwall to consider their relationships at home and abroad, the man who was once the human link in the chain between the White House and No. 10 Downing Street has said it's time to stop pretending.
It is a ludicrous standard of cooperation. It is not ever true, right? So you're pretending right away. Of course there's daylight. And again, if you look at the world like a constellation, thank goodness there's daylight. Space between people, space between things is good. Hello, I'm Matthew Barzin, author of The Power of Giving Away Power. And this is my OMI for Bocomi.
Matthew Barzin's influence on American politics was seeded back in 2008 when he used his experience in the tech industry to help the Democrats win 2 elections. He then served his country under President Barack Obama as U.S. ambassador to the U.K. for 5 years between 2013 and 2018.
So much energy, positive energy, lives in difference. Let's not be afraid of daylight. Let's not be afraid of difference. Any partnership you can think of, a couple dancing on a dance floor, soldiers fighting shoulder to shoulder, there are daylight between all of them. It would be weird, ineffective, and creepy if there weren't.
In The Power of Giving Away Power, he makes the case for replacing a pyramid-style hierarchy of control in government and business and life with a constellation mindset that lets individuals shine for the greater good.
Freedom with and through other people. And that isn't some group hug collectivist thing at all. It is actually the genius of the idea, and we've fallen short of it. The idea of America was how we can be free together.
This week, our guest leader is the multi-million best-selling author and now publisher, Simon Sinek. Here's why he wants you to read Matthew Barzin's book.
Hello, nice people at Bocomi. This is Simon Sinek. I imagine a world in which the vast majority of people wake up every single morning inspired, feel safe wherever they are, and end the day fulfilled by the work that they do. Now, it's going to take a lot of people and a lot of ideas to build that world. And one of those people is Matthew Barzin. He recently wrote a book called The Power of Giving Away Power. Now, what makes this book particularly special is I published it. I started a company called Optimism Press a few years ago with the hope that I could find the people and ideas that would help advance towards that world that I imagine. And so for me, the opportunity to not only meet Matthew Barzin, but to help put his ideas down on paper so that they can be shared, has been truly a gift and an honor. Matthew doesn't just turn the existing ideas of management and leadership upside down. He completely blows them up and starts again. And this is what I love about Matthew's work. It is imaginary, it is visionary, and it is possible to do what he proposes in The Power of Giving Away Power. I recommend that you read his book because, quite frankly, his ideas are genius. Have fun and inspire on.
Matthew Barzin, welcome to Bocomi.
Thank you for having me, Rich.
To be honest, if I sort of read out your Wikipedia page and the testimonials for the book, would cover a good hour anyway.
Thank you. It covered the good bits, right?
Right. Okay.
We tend not to list those things in our life that don't make it to the resume.
You're being very modest there. There have been some incredible highs. I'm sure there's been lows like anybody else's career. But what we're talking about today is the book you've written, this incredibly, it's a very complex book, but there's a very simple metaphor at the heart of it, or an analogy. You anchor the narrative of the book with the creation story of the Great Seal of the United States, a logo of sorts that the founding fathers, they took 6 years to agree on after the Declaration of Independence in 1776. I've been in meetings like that. Why is that story so important to you?
I love the story because it gives us this logo you mentioned, has two sides to it. And the first committee that they assigned, they put the A-team from the American perspective on it. These are the three men who had just written the Declaration of Independence, Ben Franklin, John Adams, and Thomas Jefferson. And they say, well, you guys are pretty good with words. How are you going to do here with symbols? And cutting a long story very short, they were no good at all. But the two things they did contribute to the final logo was that it ought to have two sides to it. And they did contribute as wordsmiths. They picked the motto that ended up being in the final one, which is E Pluribus Unum, from many, one. And cutting right to the end, the two symbols, the front and the back, are on the back of a U.S. dollar bill. So that's how most Americans anyway, or Brits, could see it and imagine it. One is the pyramid, a symbol of strength and durability. And the other is one that most of us have seen a lot, but we just look through it. And it's called the radiant constellation, right? So it's all these different 13 stars in particular, with sunbeams radiating out behind it. And this was supposed to be the essence of our logo, this constellation. And yet it's really the pyramid that we remember. And the pyramid, as I argue in the book, is a symbol for not only sort of obvious hierarchy, things like top down, in out, but when we get frustrated, as many of us have, with top down leadership, when we instinctively think we're doing the opposite, when we say, okay, let's be bottom up now, right? But bottom up is no better. It's the same shape. If you think of yourself or you think of others as being at the bottom, that's part of the pyramid problem. We've got to break out of that. And I think, well, the constellation is the alternative they put on the front of the logo. And we keep putting it at the back of our lives. And we shouldn't, because when they wrote E Pluribus Unum, from many, one, it literally on the dollar bill, it is right underneath the constellation. From many stars, one constellation, not from many bricks, one pyramid.
This is what I love about smart new nonfiction. I didn't know the detail of that story. You know, how many dollar bills have I held in my hand and not paid any notice to that? And the familiar figure of the eagle and the constellation, the stars and stripes and the, you know, images and language and mottos that we all take for granted, but they pass us by. And you don't realize how deeply rooted in the Constitution and in the whole of society and our cultures, language and imagery is.
Totally. And I begin the book with a great quotation from one of my favorite British authors, Samuel Butler, who wrote this great work of fiction way back called The Way of All Flesh. And he says, metaphors are misleading, but they are the least misleading thing we have.
It got me thinking when you drew attention to the E Pluribus Unum. My Latin's not what it used to be.
Mine never got off the ground.
Out of many, one, that's what that means. And the combination of that and the designer Hopkinson stars, that combination of language and imagery, and you think, well, that was a long time ago. You know, people were very slow. You know, everything around society and thinking was very slow. But you realize that the comparison to today is so clear. You know, we had Yes, We Can with Barack Obama, which really sticks in my mind. With Trump, you had his MAGA moment with his little red hat. And in the UK, we took back control with the image of a red bus. It's amazing how just a few words and a striking design can work together to shape history. Do you think that has become more common today, or has it always been thus?
If you think about sort of our, we're roughly the same age, our adult lifetime has been dominated by, I mean, you were sort of touching on slogans and I think and images. And if you take, this is American, but I think it translates. I've tested it on some British friends. I'll test it on you now and the listeners to see if this holds up. Two cars in a parking lot, and they each have only one bumper sticker on them, and they each only have one word on that bumper sticker, right? Car number one has a bumper sticker that says freedom. So car number one, freedom. Car number two, together. And if I were to ask you, which is the Republican car and which is the Democrat car, and would this hold up for Tory Labor, right? And I'm not going to make it easy. It's not red and blue cars. They're both, you know, gray. Everyone gets that right. And they say freedom for the Republicans or freedom for those who wanted Brexit or whatever. And then together for Democrats. And you can understand both the power of both of those single words. And I think over our lifetimes, we have seen freedom taken to its absolute extreme of freedom from, leave me alone. In the pandemic, we saw this, just, you know, leave me the heck alone, pure independent. Then you've seen the word together taken to its extreme, where one candidate over on this side of the pond had a bumper sticker that said, not me, us. So you give yourself up to this larger collective thing, right? And yet, and what the constellation is such a profound symbol of, is what I think we really need now more than ever is freedom together. Freedom with and through other people. And that isn't some group hug collectivist thing at all. It is actually the genius of the idea, and we've fallen short of it. The idea of America was how we can be free together, right? Any band of revolutionaries can declare independence. It's always tricky bringing up the war for independence with you guys. But, you know, that lasts about 5 minutes. And then the hard and meaningful work of how are we going to work together. So in a way, we celebrate our Independence Day. I wish we would celebrate our Interdependence Day, which was the Constitution and how states could work together, et cetera, et cetera.
It feels a little bit like you're arguing against the grain here as we become more fragmented, and freedom and liberation and identity and the, you know, the pursuit of the self, which has been more and more to the fore since Ayn Rand in the 60s and through, you know, yeah, through Reaganism, and in opposition to the collectivism of the East, say. And we define ourselves sometimes in opposition to our neighbors or even our
exactly.
enemies to a certain extent.
I think that's right. We are given a forced and false choice. We are given, in the pyramid view of the world, hey, fit in or be left out, right? Everyone can, I think, identify with the feeling it feels great to fit in. Doesn't always feel so great to be left out, but it really is a forced choice. And for those who want to be left out, or if you get frustrated with the pyramid, the tendency is to, like, forget it on your own, right? Just leave me alone. I'm okay. And again, back to the constellation, what I think we really want, and I learned this, by the way, from doing workshops with 20,000 British 18-year-olds over there, and I continued that tradition when I got back home in America, not at the same scale. You talk to these young people, they want to stand out and fit in. And if you picture a constellation, that's what it allows you to do. You have, like, stand out as a star. You are absolutely distinct. You do not lose your individuality when you decide to link up with other stars, namely other people, and make new connections that are useful that you could never do on your own. So it's definitely a both and sort of thing.
But in times of crisis, an existential threat, you present the pyramid, command and control, as the most efficient or the most rational form of organization and government. Are you sympathizing with people for leaning towards the pyramid or the command and control, you know, for strong leadership? In times of war, we need strong leadership. In times of pandemic, we need strong leadership. And have we conflated the idea of strength with command?
I do. I think it's a beautiful way of putting it. I mean, it's always risky quoting Churchill with a British crowd, but I do so in the book because I think it's a good illustration of the point you're making, which is, look, and I'm no expert on that time period, but I think it's safe to say that the D-Day operation and all the incredible logistics, to say nothing of the heroism, and the buildup to that was a pyramid project, right? Command and control, et cetera, because you were working from literally a day certain or a day uncertain, but you were working your way back from D-Day. And what do you need to get ready to be ready on D-Day? So yes, there is a time and a place for pyramids. But Churchill himself realized, and there's a wonderful scene in the book where he tells the American ambassador at the time, John Gilbert Winant, that Churchill, even in 1941, is looking past victory and saying, and then a new kind of work begins. And he has a wonderful phrase, which has since become such a cliche, no one really seems to care. But when he was confronting in 1946 in America, confronting what are we going to do about this Iron Curtain that Stalin and others are building across Europe? How are we going to fight consolidated power? And he doesn't say, let's fight it with consolidated power of our own. What he prescribes is, let's form millions of special relationships between farmers and friends on both sides of the Atlantic. And he called the speech, it's known as the Iron Curtain speech, because that's a pretty memorable phrase. And I think it's telling, it's not what he called it. He called it the sinews of peace. And so in peacetime, and to preserve peace and to grow things, you need to have these connections. I would argue these constellation-like connections between peoples and organizations. And the pyramid does not serve you well.
You mentioned your survey and your visits while you were ambassador in the UK to British school children, because you wanted to learn what they were thinking about the US. And you again slightly went against the grain, because people thought, why are you going around all these different schools? But what's really interesting, what I picked up on, is you went to different types of schools. You didn't just do the kind of normal glad handing at the nice posh schools where everybody was well trained and articulate and asked the right questions. And you went to some fairly tough audiences who would you know, wouldn't pull any punches with what they said. But I thought the most insightful thing that I found from your observation was when you addressed them as leaders of tomorrow. And the kids in the entitled school, the kids in the private schools or the fee-paying schools were like, yep, that's us. And the kids in the other schools, the selected schools, they were looking around saying, what do you mean, me? And I think you struck at the heart of British society there. That is the problem we have right at the beginning at schools. It's kind of too late further down the line. It's actually starting there with expectation and belief, self-belief. And you were a really well-educated man. You held a position of power and influence in the most powerful nation on the planet. Do you think that the idea of giving power away is a luxury, maybe, that only peaceful, prosperous, entitled, healthy, liberal societies can afford?
I haven't thought about it in that context. Let's think this through together. I don't think so. And what pops to mind is an example from one of the leaders who inspired me in this book. So it's not a country, so we'll see if it applies. But it starts with the question, as you know, Rich, who won when the richest company in the world took on one of the oldest companies in the world? And this is Microsoft taking on Encyclopedia Britannica for what was back then a very profitable encyclopedia business. And of course, the answer is neither, right? It's Jimmy Wales and his team start this thing, which we now call Wikipedia. It wasn't called Wikipedia when it launched, as you know. It was called Newpedia. But the point of that story was he's up against Microsoft, for goodness sakes, and this old established company from the 1700s. So he was not exactly prosperous and peaceful. I mean, he was scrambling and struggling to make a go of it. And he failed. And he failed really badly because he had a rigid pyramid-like system for how you were going to get an article onto Wikipedia. You know, a 10-step process to make sure nothing was plagiarized because he knew he was the new kid on the block. In the first year, he got 18 articles published. And you don't have to be a whiz at math, and Jimmy is a whiz at math, to know you're never going to catch either Microsoft or Britannica at that pace. So someone on his team says, what if we just open it up? What if we give away power? What if we let Rich write one sentence, Matthew write a paragraph, Jane fill in some of the mistakes, you know, et cetera, et cetera. In the first year, they got 18,000 articles, and the rest is history. Right, the greatest human knowledge transfer engine the world has ever seen, 240 languages. It is remarkable. And it was done by giving away power, not from a place of privilege and comfort, but from a desire to be useful and sort of get in the flow.
When you helped Barack Obama win the election in 2008, when you gave away power to unqualified, you know, interns and volunteers with the voter list, you know, the previously protected voter lists, but you gave them the power to do, and you empowered them to go and use that. I'm just thinking that maybe liberal democracy has, and the desire to work us together has been exploited by populism, and the aggression of populism, and the focus of populism in order to engage with not the angels of our better nature, but the demons within us, you know, the fear within us. And that somehow, that what I'm trying to get at about that point about prosperity and it being a luxury to give power away, is that I often think, is it that Karl Popper quote of the paradox of tolerance, about if you're tolerant of intolerance, then you're going to lose. Do you know what I mean? You've got to fight fire with fire.
And
I always think that, you go back to the initial, the mottos, and the things that have driven positive changes, or what you might see as positive changes if you're liberal minded. But now that we've sort of opened the door to threats from extremism, because now everybody knows what the playbook is, you know, a great slogan and a good image. How do we protect against leaning in the wrong direction?
Yeah. I mean, there's so much great stuff in those questions. And this is exactly what I am thinking about, struggling with. And we don't get into too much of those details in the book, but I want to write another one on exactly these kinds of topics, learning from you and others about, yeah, okay, but, you know, how does this apply to this or to that? But I do think the core of your question around liberal democracy and vulnerability of our open societies, it is a real one. What we have to guard against is that tendency to pretend that we know what the answers are. And I think liberal democracy, certainly my own, you know, in our country, we can, where we often get it wrong is that paternalistic. So it's interesting when you said give away, like a luxury of giving away power. And I had a back and forth with our amazing publishers about the title itself, which I was like, yeah, but people are going to misunderstand it because it's like, you're not giving it away. Like, I have so much, here you go, you're welcome. I mean, that's awful, right?
It's like you're endowing it to someone, isn't it? It's like, it's yours to give.
Yeah, but it is right in the sense that it requires this leap of letting go of it, and then you get it back again, and then you let it go again. So it's this wonderful flow that happens. There's a story in the book about a mentor and inspiration to me, a woman named Lynn Twist, she helped me get good at fundraising because I used to be terrible at it. She helped me get better at it. But she shared a story where she did a career change mid-career. She was working on world hunger, and then she really wanted to go work. She felt a calling to go help tribes in the Amazon fight off the devastation that was happening with deforestation. Long story short, she ends up taking this long trek into the headwaters of the Amazon, and she meets with the tribal chief, and she explains this calling she felt she's had, and he listens respectfully, and then he says through a translator, I think I understand what you want to do. If you're here to help, please leave. If you're here to help, please leave. And she thinks, you know, her heart sinks like any of ours would. She's come all this way. But then he says, if you're here because you think your liberation is inexorably tied up with our liberation, then sit, stay, let's figure this out together. And the sort of fancy term is mutual liberation. That is freedom together, we talked about earlier. Same thing. How can we be free together? And that to me is at the essence of how you really start to mend what is so obviously not working with people talking at each other, past each other, not talking at all. We started this conversation of metaphors and analogies. There's a bathroom, a public men's bathroom on the way between Boston, where I grew up, and New York. And famously, you know, the sports teams, the fans don't like one another. So written next to the mirror says, Yankees suck, the New York team. Someone scribbles it out and writes, Red Sox sucks, right? And this goes on for like probably 18 inches of scrawl. And then a guy goes in with a green Sharpie magic marker. And he circles the whole scrawling, and he says, and we all love baseball, right? Now, I didn't go back, but my suspicion is that did not settle the dispute, right? And Mr. Green Sharpie, to me, is that sort of like, I mean, yes, I think that's true. They do all love baseball. But if you tell partisan folks on either side of the pond, on either side of the aisle, that we all love baseball, I mean, I guarantee you there is lots more scrawl written about what Mr. Green Sharpie can do with that pen that we won't get into on the air here. So I think somewhere between just you suck, I suck, you know, back and forth, trench warfare of words, and hey, group hug, we all love baseball, lies the key to your question, which is we need to do the hard work of amending and mending the rules of the game we love. So I could, you know, you think about football, cricket, American football, you name it. That kind of work. So in an American baseball context, you would say, hey, should we get rid of the designated hitter rule? Red Sox and Yankee fans could have a spirited debate. They might find themselves agreeing in unforeseen ways about the rules of the game that govern us. You could see that in the Brexit debate that I got to watch in your country, that if we can get better about developing the habits of interdependence and the habits of working through things together, which gets, and I think, you know, the matron saint of the book we haven't talked about yet, and is Mary Parker Follett, right, who is the most famous guru of the 21st century, Peter Drucker. Everybody loved Peter Drucker. Business, nonprofits, governments. He reveals close to the end of his life that he had a guru. And she's this remarkable woman. I don't know if we have time to talk about what she did.
Sure.
But
yeah.
So she really, born 1868, dies 1933. In today's terms, you'd say she was the most sought after speaker on the kind of TED Talk circuit. She kind of had a killer TED Talk 100 years ago. And her point was there are four possible outcomes of a meeting, and only one of them is worthwhile. Number one, you go into the meeting rich and you try to win over your idea. That's no good, she said, because why did you even invite other people to the meeting? Number two, you acquiesce. You just think, oh, John or Jill seem really fired up. Just let them have it. It's not worth it. But that's no good, because why are you at the meeting? You have to bring your truth, as we say these days. Number three, very tempting, but she thinks it's no better than the first two, is compromise. And she says, because compromise are just little mini victories, sort of half victories and half losses. No, she said the only reason you should ever get with a group of people around a table is to do what she called, or what I call co-creation. She used the word integration, which has different, you know, connotations in the last 100 years. But something magic happens with co-creation, which is you as a small group have made something together. You were in it, it is of you and in you, but you haven't lost or diminished yourself in the process. Picture constellation. You've contributed yourself to it, you're in it, but you haven't lost yourself. You are not the sun, by the way, with everyone else orbiting around you. And I think her very practical and tactical discussions about how you take that mindset really could be better. And if you think about our politics, not Republican versus Democrat or Tory versus Labor. Like, you could start these practices just within one of those political parties. Because some of the fiercest and nastiest pyramid behavior that kills energy happens within, you know, Democrats working with Democrats, Republicans working with Republicans, the same over on your side. Start there. And so what I try to do heading into every meeting is just three things. Expect to need other people, number one. Number two, expect to be needed, right? By all means, bring your truth. And the third is expect to be changed. And this is where Mary Parker Follett says, look, that's the reciprocal part of bringing your own truth. If you leave that meeting the same person you came, you have failed to co-create something. Even if it's in a small way, everyone ought to be changed leaving that meeting. So that's why I feel that we can start super small and tactical. And if we did that over and over and over again, that pattern and that tone could be very healing.
And is that what you mean by a constellation mindset, that you take that mindset to every interaction that you have?
Exactly. Mm. You just think, I need to. And it's, again, it's sort of like Mr. Green Sharpie with We All Love Baseball. You know, at many of the rallies you'll see in the UK or here, and I generally, politically, my own politics, I sympathize with the people holding these signs. And they say, we need bridges, not walls. Right? And I know what they mean. And I sort of nod my head, so to speak. But I think Mary Follett would challenge us, and she would say, well, wait a minute. And here in Louisville, Kentucky, we just built a $2 billion bridge across the Ohio River. And so I watched it take shape. And if you watch a bridge get built, it doesn't get built from the middle. And both sides of the river build something that looks a lot like walls, right, on their way to bridging it. So in interpersonal sense, I think you'd say, look, you need to know who you are, where you come from and what you believe in, you know, which is kind of wall-like, like identity. There's nothing wrong with walling off your identity at first. Then you start to look at the, quote, other across the river, start to, you know, put them in their, don't just tolerate them, but really try to listen and all that good stuff. And then eventually, if you do that enough, you can start to see yourself in the other, and then you get the bridge. So again, constellations help. Like, I need to be a star, you're a star, now how can we make connections between us?
And it was that mindset that served you so well and served the Obama administration so well for 8 years, but probably the subject of another podcast. But I kept remembering as I was reading your book, I'd forgotten how optimistic the world felt when he was elected. It reminded me with a certain sadness and a certain nostalgia. It wasn't that long ago, but a certain nostalgia for a time when it seemed possible that we were moving in the right direction. And now at the moment, we seem to be so, you know, the liberals among us are self-flagellating, the extremists are finger-wagging and dictating, and authoritarians are imposing themselves. And it feels like, well, did that happen? Did those 8 years happen? Weren't we meant to move forward in those times? Do you ever feel that sense of nostalgia?
I do,
I'm sure you're
but
proud of what happened,
totally.
But at the same time...
Yes, and yet at the same time, I'm the wonderful British writer and columnist, A.A. Gill was his pen name. I don't know if you knew Adrian, but we became friends, sadly passed away way too young. Yeah. But I got to know him before he passed away and voraciously read lots of his books. And he has a great essay in one of them. I think it's the one about America, but I'm not sure. The Golden Shore. He says, I think the title of the chapter is Nostalgia, and he makes the point that that word is, it's like neuralgia. It's a sickness. Nostalgia is not a good thing. I think it was like the Swiss Army Far From Home or something that would like be physically upset with an unhealthy love of home. And so I'm always on the guard for that word because I don't think nostalgia will serve us well. We need to do the hard and meaningful work of mending the rules of the game we love.
So you're calling me sick now, Matthew. I'm sick in the head.
No, me too. We all are. But I just think it doesn't get you. It gets you in the wrong sort of body language if you're nostalgic.
I know exactly. Right? I know exactly what you mean. Because, you know, happiness, as we all know, is when expectation meets reality. And you can never change what's gone in the past. Correct me if I'm wrong with the language here, but it seemed like you became suddenly disillusioned or you wanted to stop pretending that you could see the future. It made you physically sick. You know, literally, you became physically sick.
Your listeners may be in the middle of a meal, so I will spare them. But anyway, it involved me all dressed up at a fancy official dinner, passing out and projectile vomiting in a very public, embarrassing way. Because for the reasons you say, I just was sort of pretending. And I got all the tests done. It wasn't physical. It wasn't food poisoning. It wasn't anything. It was me sort of just saying, I'm not doing this anymore. And it's that tone of voice that I think, unfortunately, diplomats on both sides of the country and others are sort of encouraged to speak in that seldom wrong, I'm sorry, often wrong, never in doubt, that tone. And I got good at faking it, but it never felt good. The phrase that often comes with it is, there is no daylight between the U.S. and the U.K. as it relates to, and then fill in whatever foreign policy topic is in the headlines that day. And I must have said it 1,000 times because it's just sort of a set piece. And it is a ludicrous standard of cooperation. It is not ever true. Right? So you're pretending right away, of course there's daylight. And again, if you look at the world like a constellation, thank goodness there's daylight or nightlight or whatever. You know what I mean? Like space between people, space between things is good. And that's why back to rallies, people say, you know, what unites us is greater than what divides us. And again, I'm sympathetic with that feeling, but no, not really. So much energy, positive energy lives in difference, right? We don't want one giant superstar. We want distinct things linked together. And so let's not be afraid of daylight. Let's not be afraid of difference. Any partnership you can think of, a couple dancing on a dance floor, soldiers fighting shoulder to shoulder, there are daylight between all of them. It would be weird, ineffective, and creepy if there weren't.
And you say that we have to fruitfully embrace that paradox and uncertainty that we are different and yet we all want to be the same. We want to serve without being subservient. You know, it's a difficult, tricky path to navigate. But what I found very optimistic about your book was that, A, someone else feels the same, which is always a start.
Yeah.
But B, someone who had and has, you know, a lot of influence and experience in a world that seems completely alien to many people, that it seems in control, powerful, you know, never admitting or accepting that one might be wrong. You saw it at the very heart of the most powerful nation in the world that, you know, you're just a human being that goes, enough is enough. And I've done my turn. I've done my bit. I now need to move on. Like everyone does feel in any job or any walk of life. We've all done it. We've all been in jobs where we go, I can't, do you know what? I just can't do this anymore.
Well, you know what? On the optimistic side, right towards the end of my time in London, we got a visit from one of our top diplomats, John Kerry, who was Secretary of State, did a wonderful job. He came all the time, which was great. His deputy came, who is Tony Blinken, who your listeners is now the Secretary of State. And I'll never forget this meeting. And it doesn't sound like much, but it holds to me the pattern of what gives me optimism. So he comes in. It's a meeting at number 10, Downing. And, you know, the stagecraft of how these meetings work is like the two most important people sit in these chairs next to each other. There's often a fireplace involved, right? And then the second ranking, it's basically a pyramid in living room form. And always the most junior person sort of at the edge, head down, scribbling notes. Tony comes into the meeting. He knows how it's supposed to go, right? he sits in the wrong seat on purpose, you know, like not the senior seat. He brings out a pad of paper. Like no one, he's a principal. That's, you know, in air quotes, that's the lingo. Like they're not supposed to take notes. They're supposed to, you know. Anyway, so he pulls out a notepad and he asks a open-ended, fascinating question of the most junior person in the room sitting at the other side of the back. And he just set that tone for that whole meeting. It was one of those interesting meetings I've ever been in. And I thought, wow, we need to do that more often. It was really subtle, where he sat, what he did, the pattern and tone. And we can all, and the other leaders in the book, in different ways, show us how they actually did this in a very practical and tactical way. And I think if we start doing that, because it can get so overwhelming when you look at big geopolitical everything, it's just like, oh, what can you possibly do? It's like, well, we can start seeing, thinking, and feeling and behaving in this way immediately. And when you start to take that leap to a new mindset, it is amazing. It brings out the best in others. And it only works if other people take the leap too.
Do you think that your colleagues back in Washington and the rest of the states thought that you became anglicized in a certain way because you were exposed to so many different cultural influences? You know, you lived in the UK for 5 years. You've got still maintained good friendships with English, some cultural icons.
I guess so. I mean, we probably wouldn't have put it that way, but I haven't thought about that. Yeah, I guess we would be.
You do tell us some great anecdotes in the book about your time meeting the Queen and almost in the same breath, on the same level, Jimmy Carr, which I found quite funny.
Oh my gosh, I know. I talked to Jimmy. So Jimmy became a friend, and I was like, hey, the story about you, I'm putting it in. I tell one about you, and then I tell a really good one about the Queen, and he interrupted me. He's like, Matthew, you can't do that. I was like, oh, I can't, because I love both stories. He's like, no, you can't put me before the Queen. He's like, take it from someone who knows about timing. Stand-up comics are pretty good that way. He's like, you start with the Queen, then I'm the unexpected funny man after. I was like, oh, okay. Jimmy was very smart. And the story with the Queen, interestingly, you know, you're never supposed to reveal the contents of a private audience with the Queen. Now, I learned this the hard way. I didn't mean to, you know, blab about it or whatever, but I told this story where my wife and I are standing there, you know, I just put down my top hat. I mean, it's a very strange official presentation of the credentials, very formal. We'd been trained well on how to do it. It's going wonderfully. And the Queen asked me about my background in internet technology, and I'm just sort of saying a bunch of words. I don't really remember what I said. And then we had come in by carriage into, I mean, it's crazy as an American, right? To come in a horse-drawn carriage wearing a top hat into Buckingham Palace. I mean, it's just, you notice like just the, I mean, I don't know, thousands and thousands of tourists up there snapping away, and sort of, you could hear them say like some American accents, like, are they royals? And someone was like, I don't think so. And it was just kind of fun to take it all in. Anyway, we get inside, we're having this conversation. So I said something to the Queen to the effect of, well, what is it like just having your picture taken by all those people all the time? And she said, well, they've always taken pictures, but they used to have cameras. And they would pick them up, take a picture, put them down around their neck again. And then, and she lifted her white gloved hand in front of her face to simulate an iPhone or an iPad or Android phone, whatever. And she just holds it up there and she goes, but now they put them up and they never take them down. And I miss seeing their eyes. And I thought that was just so wonderful because, to the point we made earlier, we so often think this is a one-way transaction, right? It's like the tourist being a tourist, the Queen being the Queen, and it's a one-way thing. But it was a connection. And I realized not like deeply meaningful at every level, but that series of connections she really missed. And I thought it was a wonderful lament for our times and how at a time when we can be unbelievably connectable with technology, we often feel so disconnected. And Jimmy Carr, who a few nights later, so I do my presentation to the Queen, then I'm seated next to my first stand-up comedian I've ever met. And I asked Jimmy, well, the first question I asked him was, if you're trying out 10 new jokes in Leeds or Liverpool or a place like Louisville, they generally don't do the big things first, right? They test it out. 10 new jokes, how many get a laugh? And Jimmy has he's like, well, you know, in the beginning of my career or now? And I was like, no, now. He's like, I'm pretty good. And I was like, okay. He's like, I'll get as many as 3 jokes out of 10. Isn't that amazing? I mean, so like 30% is like really good. And so I had just made this blunder saying that thing that the Queen had said out loud. So I'd sort of screwed up. The palace was very gracious, accepting my apology. But Jimmy's, then he went on and he said, but you want to know the most interesting about comedy? And I said, yes. And he said, jokes are really strange things. If you play a song and no one likes it, it's still a song. If you put on a play and everyone walks out, it's still a play. If you tell a joke and no one laughs, it's just a sentence. And I was like, did someone famous say that? And he's like, no, I said that. When he is famous. But, you know, but no. And I thought, wow, the Queen's comments and Jimmy's comments to me were like, that's it. It lives in the in-between. The comedian does his or her part. The audience does their part. But together they make a joke. And that's where I think we so often, as leaders or in general, just get that wrong. We think it's a one-way thing, and it is made between people.
Yes, it's often seen as a script rather than a dialogue. President Obama gave you one word of advice when you were starting your job as a diplomat. What would your word of advice be to the current U.S. ambassador, who I believe is the first woman in the post, Gail Lempert? Is that right?
I don't think anything's been totally officialized, so I am, having come from that world, I won't comment one way or the other on rumors that may be out there. So I, whoever it might be, you know, I would pass on the wisdom of Mary Parker Follett nearly 100 years after, well, probably almost to the day, 100 years after she made the point. Expect to need others, expect to be needed, expect to be changed in every single interaction you have over in that amazing country, in this wonderful job you're about to take.
And what was the word that, one word of advice that Barack Obama gave you?
Oh, yeah. So I'm sitting there and we talked about formal chairs in front of the fireplace. So I've seen The West Wing a million times on the television show and all those movies I'm a sucker for. But it was kind of neat to actually be in the room. I'm sitting there. I had my little notepad. And I said, Mr. President, what advice would you have for a first-time diplomat? And I remember like it was yesterday. He sort of sat back, put his hands over his knees, sort of looks up at the chandelier. And he kind of took longer than I thought. And he said, well, Matthew, listen. And I thought, yeah, I mean, I've come all this way from Kentucky. I have my notepad out. I am ready to listen to all your pearls of wisdom. But that was all he said. And it took me like too long to realize, no, the advice wasn't listen to my great advice. The advice was listen. Listen. And so that's what I tried to do over there. And listening, of course, isn't the end, right? Listening is a means to an end. So maybe this is a good way to end our wonderful discussion for now. I'd love to keep it going. When I watched President Obama and how he worked on the campaign and in leadership and read about these other leaders, I call them constellation leaders, who have built some of the most impactful organizations and inventions, Visa, Wikipedia, to name two, the internet. I mean, some amazing things. What they have in common, and the way I did it as sort of a mnemonic thing for me to remember, is it's going to spell the word also. And it's ask people about their hopes and fears, listen and link them to your own. That's the L. Serve that overlap, that shared hope, shared fear, and then open up. Ask, link, serve, open up. That if you do that, you will. That's what I watched President Obama do in cornfields in Iowa that launched him into the office. And that pattern and tone set, if you do that, can be incredibly fruitful.
Well, Matthew, I'm so glad I opened up your book and spent time with you and your head in your book. And it's been fantastic listening to you today, but sharing an excellent conversation with you. Matthew Barzin, thank you for sharing your OMI with Bukomi today.
Thank you, Rich. Appreciate it.
Matthew's book, The Power of Giving Away Power, is available to buy now in the Bukomi shop. Just follow the link in the description of this episode. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, sign up for our most wanted email at bukomi.com. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Thank you for listening. And remember, the only thing for certain is the change we know today. Bye for now.